Well, we might as well just get going, and if there are other people that come in, go ahead and let them come in. So this panel is called Motherhood from the Margins, and myself and a few friends of mine at Duke University, where we go, put it together a while ago. I'm Sarah, and I'm a graduate student, a PhD candidate in the program in literature there. And I wrote a little bio for myself, assuming that there would be a chair for someone to read it. So I'll just read it real quick. You can be my chair.
And how do you pronounce your second name?
Uphel.
Uphel. Mm-hmm. Sarah Uphel is a PhD candidate in the program of literature at Duke University. The paper she'll be presenting today, Good Night to the Old Story, Orphan Motherhood and the
politics
of social protection in Catherine Arnold's The Amazing True Story of a Teenage Single Mom, is a recently redrafted excerpt from a dissertation chapter by the same name. Sarah's work focuses on the connection between upward mobility, class identity, and alternative social formations in writing, art, and scholarship by and about women from poverty backgrounds.
All right.
Thank you.
Glad to know you. Glad to know you too. Sue, your name is familiar to me. Maybe from these conferences or something.
No, I have a better one for a while with my books right here.
Okay.
My books represent me.
All right.
And I'm a mom.
And you're also a mom. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. So my paper is called Good Night to the Old Story, Orphan Motherhood and the Politics of Social Protection. And another thing I forgot. I have visual aid for y'all, so go ahead and take one of these. These are some of the images I'll be looking at in the presentation. And you too. All right. Orphan Motherhood and the Politics of Social Protection and Catherine Arnoldi's The Amazing True Story of a Teenage Single Mom. In most stories starring younger adolescent boys, it could be placed within what Bruce Robbins has named the upward mobility genre of U.S. American and British literature, an orphan protagonist's relationship to his mother is pretty cut and dry, meaning that the mother is out of the picture, dead or otherwise permanently estranged from the events that structure the narrative, save as the sad specter of a past that the boy is assumed to be better off having left behind. A reader has only to notice the condescension expressed by the doctor reluctantly charged with delivering Dickens' Oliver Twist to understand the necessity of this arrangement. Leaning over the body of Oliver's dead mother, this surgeon raises the woman's left hand. "The old story," he said, shaking his head. "No wedding ring, I see. Ah, good night, and good riddance," the implication goes. Occasionally, the mother's death is treated as the severance of a legitimate nuclear family from its constitutive member. In James Vance and Dan Burr's graphic novel, Kings in Disguise, protagonist Freddie's estranged father leaves his son's farewell letter directly linking his wife's death to the drying up of work opportunities during the Great Depression. "She is gone forever, and so is my work. And that is why I have stopped being a man," he explains in a shaky, alcohol-induced scrawl. And yet, regardless of the conditions of her untimely demise, it seems that the more quickly the mother can be exercised in the story, the better the boy protagonist's ability to maximize the manly character, independence, and willingness to work hard underlying his inevitable rise towards social respectability, as Horatio Alger's Ragged Dick is charmingly fond of saying. But when it comes to stories featuring female orphans, not only does the mother often refuse to give up the ghost physically, but she generally insists on sticking around in one form or another, making trouble or otherwise directly contributing to the stress of her daughter's life. Even when the girl's birth mother has graciously vacated the narrative premises, any and all substitute mother figures tend to serve as obstacles rather than helpmates toward the boys or toward the hero's achievement of her goals. In Harold Gray's classic comic strip, Little Orphan Annie, not only is 11-year-old Annie forced to endure the wrath of orphanage overseer Miss Asthma, a stern, gender-deviant hag in a tie and oddly pants-like skirt who makes Carol Burnett look positively ladylike, but when she is finally taken on trial by an adopted family, Mrs. Warbuck's power-hungry, castrating energy renders both Daddy Warbuck's and his hard-earned millions incapable of having anything other than a disposable impact on Annie's present and future. And you can see Miss Asma there in figure one. Indeed, Daddy's paternalistic impotence as a capitalist father capable of protecting Annie or providing her with any asset more steady than his kindness serves as justification for the brutally misogynist message at the heart of the comic, that in a world where unnatural women like Mrs. Warbucks exist, Men are caught between the rock and a hard place of either abandoning the family altogether, as Daddy does time and again with his well-timed business trips to Siberia in the midst of domestic strife, or using physical or sexual violence to keep such bad mothers in their rightful place. Though Daddy's benevolence keeps him from exercising the latter option, the possibility of its realization or its continual deferral haunts both Daddy and Annie's interactions in the greater narrative universe of the comic strip. Beneath Blue Orphan Annie's critique of unnatural expressions of femininity, a critique reinforced by the unconditional love that good girl Annie showers on her daddy, despite his continued abandonment of her, lies a backhanded endorsement of a damaging form of what is being stereotyped in this comic as working class masculinity. Daddy's origin story is itself that of the upwardly mobile boy orphan turned working class machinist turned profiteering munitions entrepreneur during World War I. A BP man and wives defenders, Daddy is portrayed as not having abandoned his wisecracking, uncultured working class mannerisms in the process of acquiring his fortune, causing a reader to wonder, among other things, exactly how a man more like Ralph Cramden than Rockefeller managed to penetrate the world of big business. What he did lose on the way up, however, was his ability to keep his greedier by the minute wife in line. Gray links Daddy's loss of masculine authority to the softening effects of the process of upward mobility, resulting in the loss of the pow right in the kisser line that often feels like the only righteous response to Mrs. Warbuck's unconditionally self-serving ways. Annie, therefore, serves not only as a youthful corrective to Mrs. Warbuck's corrupted femininity, but as a figure of redemption for the various mistakes Daddy admits to having made in his life, particularly the mistake of having amassed his butts off of war, fought on the backs of working-class men more manly than he, for which his wife's vampiristic profiteering and his inability to ever make her happy with his blood money becomes the albatross around his neck. The appropriately feminine sympathy that Annie displays toward Daddy is perversely counterbalanced by the image of Daddy ecstatically leaping in the air, fist-pumping and cheering on Annie as she delivers a much-deserved pounding to one Selby Elder Pickleberry of the Herring Pickleberries, the unabashedly faggy boy ward with slick-back hair and widow's peak that Mrs. Warbuck imports from an English old-money family. Annie literally smashes the vamp boy's face into the floor over and over, a la Tony Soprano, and she ensures him, "I'm going to keep right on bouncing your pan on that floor till you holler enough, or until I give out." And you can see that in figure two there. Selby's inaudibly mumbled "nuff, nuff" therefore becomes, for Daddy, both a moment of vicarious self-flagellation, referring to his own ability to say inability to say "nuff, nuff" to his wife, and a reclamation of the value of decidedly working-class brand of masculine violence, all the clearer in its class valences and its administration here by a roughneck orphan girl. Okay, but what about those orphan girls who, far from dutifully serving as strong-arm enforcers of a value system underwritten by a belief that all good working-class men would embrace their protector role if they themselves were provided with protection from threatening forms of deviance from heteropatriarchal norms, become orphans precisely because no one, their blood mothers included, is saying enough to the conditions governing these norms? What about the girl who, like Oliver Twist's mother, presumably becomes an orphan by becoming a mother as well? Can the tale of an orphan mother with the old story, that of the empty left ring finger, become one of upward mobility rather than death and exorcism from the leagues of those with the gumption to rise? How might such a story be told? Moreover, if more such stories were told, in what ways might their telling also challenge the conditions of possibility framing that other old story, the one that names the privatized nuclear family and its accomplice, neoliberal free market capitalism, as the only legitimate forms of kinship and communal exchange through which a functional social reality might be organized? How might examining the process of an orphan mother's rise to a position that one might call spectability make possible a new and pressing conversation about the definition and value of this elusive endpoint? Putting aside for the moment the nonsense that I should say something about Sapphire's novel Push and the recent film Precious based on the novel, for Precious Jones is in many ways the quintessential teen orphan mother, with her own bad mother dogging her every attempt to escape from the poverty, illiteracy, and self-effacement defining much of her young life. I'd like to spend the remainder of this paper discussing an autobiographical story written by a one-time single mother who was able to access the process of acquiring middle-class educational and other forms of social capital, generally called upward mobility, Catherine Arnaldi's graphic novel, The Amazing True Story of a Teenage Single Mom. A story, like Push, that was published within 2 years of the passing of the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, otherwise known as welfare reform. Though Arnaldi's story is set during an earlier time in the history of women's struggle for self-determinacy amidst various forms of anti-feminist, pro-family values pontificating, the early 1970s, pre-Roe versus Wade, and post-Daniel Patrick Moynihan's denunciation of black matriarchal communities as responsible for most of the ills underlying U.S. social inequality, protagonist Kathy struggled to support herself and her baby, Stacy, while refusing to abandon the dream of acquiring a college education, both conforms to and puts a unique pressure on the parameters of the upward mobility genre of storytelling and its ideological linchpin, the American dream of ruggedly individualistic hard work and self-motivation begetting the fairy tale ending known as success. As I hope to show, Kathy's story is at once typical of mobility story genre conventions in its inflection with the strain of self-interested self-reliance, which takes the shape of a supermom narrative that finds structural and generic support in the comic medium that Arnaldi employs to tell her story, and atypical, perhaps radically so, in the way it ultimately de-emphasizes self-sufficiency in place of a deferral to a scattered yet concatenated network of working-class benefactors that continually comes to Kathy's rescue throughout the story, providing her with resources and knowledge that it takes to eventually achieve her goal of enrolling in Denver's Metropolitan State College. Kathy's deep and abiding awareness of the value of the capital being dispensed by this working class network, as well as her sense of the struggle that remains to ensure that this network can continue to do its good work in a way that could account for more than just a lucky few like herself, shapes the narrative contours and grassroots activist motivations behind a story that Arnaldi was compelled to share as a means to, quote, help single moms feel worthy to pursue their right to an equal access to education and provide them with the information to do so. As Kathy's story begins, there's little to indicate that she is anything other than an orphan, but there's also little that tells us this is going to be, or even could be, an upward mobility story. Unlike Rag and Dick, whose story begins with a boy being roused from his straw bed on the New York streets by a gruff yet well-meaning mystery citizen, who immediately clues the reader into Dick's inherent worthiness after a brief conversation about the lowly nature of theft, Kathy's world appears to be one of complete disconnect from a sense of home, place, or properly adult social influence. Over the first four pages, Arnaldi provides the reader with nothing more than an assortment of panels drawn in her signature Charlie Brown-like rudimentary cartoon style, showcasing a young mother and baby alone yet together. At 17, I had a kid, a text box narrates, and we are shown baby Stacy face up, squirming and completely filling out the black background panel. And you can see that in figure 3A. Panels to follow, employing a kind of cartoon zoom-in camera effect, showcase parts of the baby's body that Kathy finds especially wonderful. A list full of, quote, amazing, or a fist full of, quote, amazing little itty-bitty fingernails, a perfectly beautiful-shaped head, and then, over the course of three full-page panels, a reader is witness to a rapturous bonding moment between mother and child, complete with sprays of hearts, white light, and heart borders around each panel. To me, she was the most beautiful thing in the world, Kathy proclaims, proudly holding a smiling Stacy up for the reader to admire as much as she clearly does. In this narration of the centrality of the mother-child love bond to Kathy's life, the baby is literally observed in fragments, pointing out not only the closeness shared between two individuals whose lives are intertwined to a degree that the child's itty-bitty fingernails become a featured exhibit on this tour of love, but a lack of spatial clues from which answers as to how the child got there and how the mother-child duo wound up wherever it is they may be could be gleaned. Since, giving nothing but black backgrounds, hearts, close-ups, and white light, we are denied the establishing shots or frames we would need to glean a better sense of social context. From one perspective, Kathy and Stacy's complete disconnect from the social might make them, as a kind of unified hero independent sidekick team, much like Annie and her doll Emily Marie, an even purer subject for the possibility of upward social advancement than Ragged Dick or Annie, the latter whose life prospects from the very first four-panel Chicago Tribune strip running on August 5, 1925, are already being contextualized through her relationship with Miss Asthma within the institutional space of the orphan home. And you can see that kind of in figure four, which is that first comic strip. As Robbins reminds us, the orphan home becomes a figurative darling of upward mobility stories precisely because she or he is assumed to lack a social history. Orphanhood seemingly extracts the upwardly mobile protagonist from any necessary or built-in ambivalence, he says, removing the tenderness of early attachment that would guarantee later conflicts of loyalties. Thus, the scenario of seeming to belong to no place, with no one around to influence the development of their loyalties or tender attachments, might place Kathy and Stacy in a prime position to develop and actualize self-interest necessary to effectively stimulate process of upward mobility. Truly, one of the most significant roadblocks that Ragged Dick faces in his progress towards social respectability, that's respectability, is the allegiance he feels toward the street culture of boy bootblacks from which he comes. Only after making friends with a wealthy boy mentor who provides him with clean, well-fitting clothes and a mirror does Dick find the motivation necessary to begin his social climb. Gazing at his improved reflection, he internalizes both an intense desire for this new self-image and a sense of shame in the culture from which his previous costume came. Interestingly, the only hint of a sociality outside that of the mother-child bond that Arnaldi gives us in these first four pages is the barely perceptible figure of a cartoon factory, its smokestacks billowing to the left of a portrait-style drawing of Kathy and Stacy. The partial caption, "and became a teenage single mother," placed overhead to remind us what it means to have had a kid at 17. With no traditional husband or father figure present in the no place of this woman-centered landscape, the inclusion of the factory within this happy family portrait foreshadows the reality of inevitable social and institutional engagements to come. And you can see that in figure 3A, panel 2, that little mini factory you can barely see. So when, over the course of the next several pages, the reader is acquainted with a more fleshed out sense of Kathy's personal goals, as well as some of the missing details underlying her and Stacy's origin story, it is significant that these details appear to only enhance rather than mitigate Kathy's status as both orphan and mother, or the truly single status of her teen motherhood, as one might have it. The tour of love montage provided us with a solid sense that Stacy, so far the only observable object of tender attachment for Kathy, will undoubtedly affect the mother's loyalty, goals, and decision-making process. On the fifth page, we are granted evidence of the more self-interested side of Kathy, who, she reminds us herself, is still only 17, still in touch with the desire to become, quote, what I was becoming before I had a kid, a scholar, a ballerina, maybe an artist, according to the youthful dreamscape that Arnaldi illustrates here, and that's figure 5A. However, though spatially and artistically continuous with the three panels preceding it, we are then witnessed in the fourth panel to an abrupt change in the comic's up to now buoyant, optimistic tone. We are shown an overhead view of Kathy lying face up in a bed, noticeably frowning, holding the swaddled figure of Stacy. But someone said I made my bed, so I should lie in it. I should lie in it, the caption narrates, with the all-caps expressions bummer, triple bummer, way bummer, and, most prominently, rude awakening, scrolled around the outside of the panel. And you can see that in figure 5A, the very last panel. Though plucky Kathy dares to defy this rude awakening by continuing to, quote, dream of somewhere with no discouraging words, while nonetheless sprawled on the bed they said she made, Arnaldi attempts to reckon with the mysterious someone confining Kathy to her bed in two panels that follow, and that's figure 5B, the last couple of panels. Jutting from beneath the anonymous cover of a rectangular caption stating, I asked my mother for help, but she raised three kids alone, are two sets of log-like cartoon legs, each surrounded by several other pairs of more spindly stick figure legs and a blob-like figure of a baby crawling toward one of these leg tiles. My sister had four kids, Kathy continues to explain. A figure of a sailboat on water and a panel border of pies, each with only one piece cut out, represents her family member's response to her request for help. I only had one, they said. I had it easy. Compared to the leg piles threatening to consume her mother and sister, life with one baby is assumed to be smooth sailing, a mere piece of cake. With these last few panels, Arnaldi is waging the first of numerous critical engagements with the logic governing who is and is not presumed to be a worthy subject for the process of upward mobility, and how, once this worthy subject is chosen, opportunities for the hero's deserved progress are to be presented and put into motion. Ironically, a reader's initial engagement with Ragged Dick is also from the position of a protagonist lying in a bed, a box of straw on the street, that he is presumed to have made for himself. Only, instead of being chastised by an unnamed someone insisting that he continue as a result of an irreversible mistake, to lie in the bed and accept the consequences of a blown opportunity to realize his dreams, Dick is roused from his slumber by a stranger and scolded firmly for being a lazy vagabond, yet is ultimately determined to be a good, capable, and even in Alder's own creepily interested authorial assessment, quote, decidedly good-looking boy. Adding insult to Kathy's injury, Dick is assumed to be the ideal candidate for ascendancy in the world of homosocial capitalist business relations, even before the boy himself decides that this is the path he wants to pursue. Based merely on clues Alder gives us that attest to Dick's innately superior character, his honest face, eye for speculation, and a noble nature exempting him from, quote, all mean faults. We accept Dick as deserving of the resources showered on him by wealthy benefactors who seem to be waiting for him around every corner. Regardless of the fact that, at the beginning of the story, he is locked in an earn and spend cul-de-sac that one might associate with a pathologized culture of poverty, such as the orphan bootblack culture of which he has been a part. There is clearly gender essentialism at play in determining who and should not lie in various beds that he or she may or may not have made, and essentialism linked directly, as Alger's obsession with Dick's noble physiognomy makes clear, to the bodies through which social opportunity and limitation are assigned. For Kathy, the visible sign of having diverted from the normative pathway to success available to her as a teenage girl striving to achieve her dreams. A pathway, as anthropologist Wendy Luttrell delineates, whose steps are, quote, finish school, get a job, get married, and then have kids, in that order, is the baby she cradles in her damning bed. Kathy's disorderly bodily conduct has rendered her unworthy to claim her status as what Vivian Adair calls a rights-bearing citizen, in the way that Dick, merely by being a male of full bodily integrity, is able to do. Moreover, having sacrificed the right to claim herself due to her abnormally obtained child appendage as a fully public citizen, or one worthy of the kind of public citizen intervention that Dick receives around every corner, the only viable option left for social for aid or social welfare that Kathy can pursue is to turn to her own privatized nuclear family arrangement, a situation that, as Kathy's family members have made clear, is barren as a source of both economic and emotional support. Whether or not Kathy's mother and sister are complicit members of the broader social someone damning her to her bed, they are at least admitting that their own depleted stockpile of resources, symbolized by the spindly legs surrounding them and another baby crawling toward the pile, renders it impossible for them to provide Kathy with the kind of leg up that comes so easily to Dick, who has presumably earned such good welfare through his willingness to play by the rules. Kathy says his orphan mother is therefore doubly solidified. Not only have her pleas for aid been rejected by her own family, but the cruel indifference inherent to the welfare reform logic of personal responsibility that confines Kathy to her bed ensures that she must either sacrifice her goal of attending college, disappearing further into her bed by becoming a member of a permanent underclass who, you know, for whom low wage jobs, little opportunity for advancement are the status quo, or accept the personal responsibility imperative by striving to become what Jane Jupper calls the self-supporting single mom. In Single Mother, the emergence of the domestic intellectual, Jupper describes how U.S. popular political culture, particularly since welfare reform, has come to embrace the single mother as the ideal neoliberal subject of freedom. But only, Jupper is quick to add, if she can demonstrate this freedom as, quote, freedom from any form of dependency, save, of course, the socially legitimate dependency of marriage to a man. A reader definitely gets the sense that Arnaldi's autobiographical heroine is in many respects exactly this kind of self-sufficient neoliberal representative. Not only is Kathy's story conspicuous in the complete absence of social welfare from its narrative universe, perhaps gesturing in Arnaldi's defense to rules governing the welfare system of the late 60s and 70s that required adults to participate in the bureaucratically messy work incentive program to be eligible for AFDC, but the supermom strain of the story is representationally present as early as the title page, and you can see that in figure 6. In addition to the title itself, with the all-caps word amazing outlined in cartoon zigzags, indicating that this will be a story of exception to the general rule of teenage single motherhood, Arnaldi illustrates the Kathy Stacy duo according to conventions of a typical superhero comic splash page, or the opening page of any comic book, whose function is, as Will Eisner explains, to, quote, seize the reader's attention and prepare his or her attitude for the events to follow. Outlined in a spray of white lightning, the Kathy Stacy duo, drawn as a kind of hero sidekick two-headed monster, appears to bust straight through the page with Kathy's cape-like hair and bald, three-dimensional fist, challenging any brave reader to doubt her capacity for self-sufficiency. However, if one takes seriously Bruce Robbins' critique of the commonly accepted notion that upward mobility stars are supposed to provide some sort of inspiration for the reader, on the contrary, as Robbins says, mobility stories often leave readers feeling crappy because, quote, they themselves may fall short of the success they are being asked to contemplate. One wonders whether channeling the supermom is the best strategy to help other single moms feel worthy to claim and pursue the right to a college education, which is Arnaldi's stated goal with her project. Indeed, Jupper warns that one major reason to avoid a premature celebration of the single mother's arrival into the realm of social legitimacy is precisely the reinforced condemnation of dependence at the heart of such acceptance. It seems especially dangerous to extol the powers of the self at a time when social support is steadily dwindling, Joffer says. And Arnaldi's orphan mother, Carolyn, accepted in no place and anticipating no social safety net other than what she can provide for herself, might be said to be doing just that. Okay. I'm going to end this discussion now in the absence of time, but I plan to spend the remainder of the dissertation chapter from which this paper was drawn arguing that Arnaldi undercuts the story of self-sufficiency delineated above by offering Kathy an unofficial safety net of working-class helpmates who provide her with a pool of resources that enable her to make progress toward her goal of attending college. Waitresses who offer her camaraderie and secrets of the trade, a good friend who gives her a place to stay when she needs it most, a series of truck drivers who escort her from Arizona to Denver, Colorado, following an episode of domestic abuse, her fellow workers at a latex glove factory who provide her with the class consciousness raising and sense of the value of her labor through involvement in strikes and collective bargaining, and another single mother, Jackie Ward, who offers her the middle-class capital from the other side that she needs to finally achieve her college dream. Though Kathy's independent streak realistically acknowledges the individual strength that single moms must harness in a world that pathologizes their behavior at the antithesis of personal responsibility, her story offers an explicit critique of both the social welfare system inadequate to the needs of single mothers and of marriage and the nuclear family as a privatized solution through which these inadequacies can best be addressed. What Kathy receives as the precursor to her official liberal arts education via the network that adopts her is an education in the material and political value of the working class capital that she carries with her to college. She plans to use this capital, in addition to the middle class assets that she begins to acquire, to continue to fight for the right of single mothers to, as Joffer puts it, construct family formations and political identities around single mothering as a preferred and chosen, yet socially interdependent alternative to the nuclear family.
Thank you.
Yeah, go for it.
So my name is Lee Campbell-Moore, and I am also a graduate student at Duke University, currently writing my dissertation in the field of cultural anthropology. So Sarah and I work on really similar issues, as you'll see, but from different sort of disciplinary perspectives.
Well, before you start, let's understand that I have never been to college.
Mm.
Okay, so, and I was a machinist, and I raised 5 kids, and the machinist paid. So, like, I understand everything that you said, you know, and the way you're saying it and everything, so that, but maybe we can more like talk or something, instead of, I don't want to stop you from reading your thing because that's what you came to do in everything.
Okay. Well, I think I will read my paper, but maybe we can. I can stop somewhere in the middle where I feel like it would be appropriate and kind of try to have more of a conversation or something.
Sure.
Okay, so we'll see. So, okay, no, I appreciate that suggestion. So, so my paper is called "Who Are You Calling Exploitative? Child Labor's Sacrificial Mothers and the Uncaring State in Lima, Peru." Although I might have changed the title if I were going to write the paper, if I were writing it now as opposed to when I handed in the abstract.
Did you go to Peru to do this?
I did. So it'll come out anyway.
All right.
Stepping off the sweaty public bus, I noticed that the intersection where I had been doing field work for a year seemed strangely desolate for a sunny Saturday in the middle of the summer. The intersection, a border of sorts, separated the middle and the upper class sections, as well as the commercial and residential zones of one of Lima, Peru's wealthiest districts. On the east side of the city, it also functioned as a conduit for buses traveling to and from the shanty towns, that sat just beyond the wealthy suburbs. A last stop on the long road to the Andean highlands, to which most shantytown residents trace their roots. It was late March, typically a busy time at the intersection, not just in terms of traffic, but for the kids who commuted there from the city's edges, up to an hour and a half away by bus, to work under the traffic light as street performers, windshield washers, and candy vendors. These were the kids upon whom my ethnographic fieldwork focused. So with summer vacation slowly giving way to the imposing academic year, more children than ever flocked to the intersection day after day to make money to help their families pay for school supplies, uniforms, shoes, and registration fees, all costs associated with attending public school. Just as the constant flow of private automobiles provided the kids with a potential clientele for their work activities, the steady stream of upwardly mobile families that walked out of the corner Kentucky Fried Chicken with leftovers kept the kids' stomachs full. Perplexed by the corner's emptiness on this particular day, I made my way over to Julia, the owner of the kiosk adjacent to the KFC entrance, who always knew the kids' whereabouts. They came early today, she informed me as she rearranged a few bags of potato chips. But a couple of camiones, trucks, passed by, and everyone fled to avoid the batida, a roundup. On the off chance someone had decided to risk sticking around, I walked to the quieter intersection on the other end of the strip mall and found 12-year-old Alfredo, a regular, resting in a grassy patch by the road. Alongside him sat Celia, a 32-year-old who sold candy car to car, and her four daughters, who occasionally helped her out with sales, but mostly just kind of hung out. Before I could say hello, Alfredo took an unexpected and somewhat playful jab at Celia. You're going to get put away in Maranguita for mothers, he shouted, referring to an imaginary mother's version of Lima's juvenile jail. You exploit your daughters by bringing them here and making them sit all alone on the side of the road while you work, he continued, half laughing. Who are you calling exploitative? She immediately chimed back. I bring my daughters to work with me so that I can watch over them. Leaving them at home would be exploitative because something could happen to them. And to make it a double whammy and engage him on his own terms, she said, besides, your mother's the exploitative one. I bet she stays at home while you come and work and then beats you if you don't bring home enough money. To this accusation, Alfredo retorted, that's not true. I don't bring my money home. I come here to make money for my vicios, vices, buying junk food and playing video games at the internet arcade. So, 11 months earlier, on a typical April day when the gray winter was threatening to intervene upon the lingering summer, I stepped off the same bus to find the corner replete with children. As I walked over to the sidewalk area that separated Julia's kiosk from the KFC entrance, the kids' main gathering point I had learned in my first few weeks of fieldwork, I noticed a 6-year-old girl sitting by the kiosk. Unsuccessful at engaging her in conversation, I remained puzzled about her place at the intersection. The way the boys teased her suggested that they knew her. Yet, unlike them, she didn't have juggling balls or a bag of candy to indicate that she was working, nor did she ever move, except for an occasional stride towards the KFC exit, where customers seemed more enthusiastic about offering their leftovers to her than to the more aggressive boy. The other new person that day was a plump woman who, arm in arm with a boy I had seen juggling during my previous visit, moved from car to car, holding out a tattered paper cup for donations. The distance limited my vision, but her begging style suggested that she was blind. After a half hour within my peripheral gaze, she headed away from the traffic, and before I could blink my eyes, the little girl was showering her with kisses, guiding her to a stool by the kiosk, and requesting change to buy a snack. Soyla and Sandrita, it turned out, were mother and daughter. Glad to finally have some female companionship in what was a predominantly masculine space, I slowly got to know Soyla, Sandrita, and Soyla's other daughters, 11-year-old Jocelyn and baby Selena. Several years earlier, Soyla worked near the home she shared with her two daughters, but then they were two, and her unreliable alcoholic mother, selling recyclables from the garbage. Competition was fierce, and Soyla needed a more dependable source of income. So one day, a neighbor convinced her to try begging at the intersection. "I'll be your guide, and we'll split the money half and half," she explained to Soyla. Unfamiliar with the area, physically incapable of moving around the city on her own because of her blindness, and humiliated by the idea of begging, Soyla nevertheless thought of her daughters and decided it was worth a try. Over time, she began to employ the kids who worked at the intersection as her guides. But since they came from different neighborhoods, the responsibility of helping Soyla with the chaotic commute between home and work was left to Jocelyn. And once she was older, to Sandrita as well, explaining Sandrita's place at the intersection that first day I met her, when I noticed that she didn't seem to be working. So 10 months later, Jocelyn, 1 month before that initial conversation that I talked about between Alfredo and Celia, Jocelyn, so the 11-year-old daughter, and I sat together on the bench in a discreet, covered-over part of the strip mall that separated the main intersection from the one where Alfredo and Celia had staged their pointed exchange. "Problems come and go," remarked the contemplative Jocelyn, whose reflection in the window of the home renovation boutique made it look as if her doppelganger was speaking to me from her newly tiled kitchen floor. "They come when it's the end of the month and we have to pay rent, or when we owe people money. Later the problems go away, but they come back again. They go away, come back, go away, come back." "So some of the problems are money problems," I clarified. "Yes," Jocelyn affirmed, "some of the problems are family problems, money problems. Or sometimes it's the people trick you. There are so many different kinds of problems. Sometimes when my mom doesn't have any money, we don't eat. Like yesterday, we didn't eat anything, not in the morning nor in the afternoon." "Wow," I said, "nothing at all, not even a cracker?" Jocelyn elaborated, "Nothing. We had to go to school like that. My head felt weird. I did my work slowly. I was weak, you could say. When I don't eat, I'm weak. I can't write, I can't add. I do my work wrong. Instead of writing nota, I write noto, indicating a spelling error." "So you can't concentrate," I said. "No," Jocelyn replied. "But I don't like to tell people these things. When the teacher asks me what's wrong, I say nothing. Because if I tell her that I haven't eaten, she'll tell my mom off. If I tell her that I haven't eaten, she'll say, these kids, they don't eat. And she'll think all sorts of things. She'll send us to the orphanage. But they're equivocando, getting it wrong. And upon equivocando, they're bringing on problems against me and my mom. Mostly against my mom." So in this paper, I want to argue that what Jocelyn calls bringing problems against me and my mom is central to the way that state power works in contemporary Peru, through politics of the family that imagines deviant motherhood through children's bodies. This discourse of maternal deviance, reproduced in multiple endless sites, school, the street, and so many other places, profoundly shapes the way that poor children must perform their own precarious identities as they go about making their lives, their everyday lives, both meaningful and productive. And as their daily survival practices necessitate that they transgress global and national norms for childhood, now, childhood is supposedly a time of innocence and protection, children who work on the street, I contend, reveal how a sort of differentiated, unequal form of citizenship is produced through children's bodies. So a foundational aim of cultural anthropology, my discipline, was to understand how, in different cultural contexts, the family form, confers social legitimacy upon its individual members and correspondingly functions as a basic unit in structuring society. Over time, this approach found critiques from within the discipline. In the early 1980s, David Schneider, an anthropologist, argued that in their cross-cultural search for family, anthropologists had been short-sightedly mapping Western forms of knowing onto other cultures. Early feminist anthropologists critiqued the discipline's naturalization of the family and focused instead on demonstrating how the patriarchal family structure reproduces gender-based inequalities. Some anthropologists, like Carol Stack in the 1970s, conducted fieldwork in poor urban communities of color in the United States to prove that so-called deviant kinship practices were actually evidence of adaptive survival strategies among communities historically marginalized by an oppressive system. Later anthropologists, like Nancy Shepherd Hughes, studying mother practices in Brazilian shantytowns, problematized Western notions of bad mothering by relativizing concepts such as love and care. More recently, anthropologists have asked how the heterosexual nuclear family operates as a normalizing discourse, producing corresponding models of deviance that reproduce old structures of inequality. Others have traced how the family is being remade in new sites as global capitalism inaugurates new technologies and new modes of information. Grounded in an effort to address systemic inequalities by examining the forms through which patriarchal models continue to reproduce gender difference, many feminist critiques of the family fail to see the child as more than simply a symbol of what binds women into their unequal gender roles. When it comes down to it, many feminist analyses reproduce the notion of children as sort of object of reproduction or blank slate upon which culture is imprinted, failing to take into account how children themselves respond to their own subjectivization and how indeed children participate actively in cultural production. As a feminist anthropology of childhood, I see children as both sites of struggle and also active participants in these struggles. So for the purposes of this panel, I'm interested in examining the kinds of childhoods that accompany motherhood from the margins. In doing this, I reject culture of poverty and other reductionist arguments about child socialization, instead drawing my insights from the lived experiences of a few of the child laborers with whom I've conducted fieldwork over the last several years. I attempt to interpret what it means to exist not so much as a stigmatized mother, but as a stigmatized child of a stigmatized mother. So getting back to my conversation with Jocelyn, in explaining why she must withhold information from her teacher, she begins by speaking in the third person singular about her teacher. She'll say, these kids, they don't need it, and she'll think all sorts of things. She'll send us to the orphanage. She then switches to the third person collective to refer to a more abstract subject that's getting it wrong by blaming her mother for her inadequate care and creating problems for the family. She says that they're getting it wrong, they're bringing on problems against me and my mom. This indicates her awareness that the mistaken knowledge upon which her teacher might act is not individualized, but rather part of a larger body of knowledge that marks poor families as legible and deviant. In other words, Jocelyn's critique invites us to see the potential encounter between her teacher and herself as a reflection of how moments of misrecognition that take place within the school are linked to broader processes in which poor children must engage the system defensively to avoid further encroachment upon their families. Perhaps Jocelyn had actually had such an encounter with a teacher, and indeed, many mothers that I worked with recounted for me their humiliating experiences being called in by teachers to discuss their exploitative mothering practices, what the teachers call exploitative mothering practices, or maybe Dr. Lynn was broadly gesturing towards the impossibility of ever achieving freedom from the specter of the state. Using the verb equivocarse to make an error or a mistake in describing dominant understandings of her family as dysfunctional, her mother as neglectful, and herself as available for intervention, Jocelyn emphasizes her everyday encounter with the state as a problem of competing knowledge. Yet despite her knowledge that what the teacher knows, or thinks she knows, is wrong, Jocelyn is powerless to challenge the structures responsible for these repeated violences. Instead, she responds to the state's threat to break her family by withholding information, reproducing the institutionalized misunderstandings through which social control operates. The perverse power of the uncaring state, then, is not simply that it fails to provide basic needs for its citizens, like blind mothers, but that it reproduces poor families as deviant, abandons these families, and blames them for their own plight, forcing mothers and children into a state of constant self-policing. In building such narratives of individual responsibility into the institutional machinery of everyday life, the state releases itself of accountability, obliging or obligating particular citizens faced with the possibility of losing their already precarious rights to sacrifice their physical well-being and manipulate knowledge as a matter of survival and as a mode of existence. So Jocelyn, and then also Alfredo back on the street corner with Clelia, both draw attention to the many sites through which the state diffuses its effects. From the street, the place where the child's body by default signifies deviant motherhood, to the school, the quintessential disciplinary institution for children, the place where responsible parents are supposed to send their children. Both Jocelyn and Alfredo are aware of how their own bodies signal maternal deviancy, and both respond to what they know their interlocutors think they know about them by manipulating, but stopping short of explicitly challenging dominant knowledge. Jocelyn achieves this by withholding information, teacher, and Alfredo by redeploying the gaze to Clelia. If Jocelyn fears the state's classifying power, then Alfredo appropriates the state's classifying language, at least in part to defend his mother from being represented as lazy, abusive, and coercive, and to establish his own independence. The exchange between Alfredo and Clelia did not emerge out of nowhere. It just placed literally in the shadow of a poster the municipality had posted on a light post a few weeks earlier, which read, "This zone prohibits street vending, begging, and the public sale of services. Beginning Monday, March 17th, the municipal police will eradicate, seize the goods of, and fine all individuals who fail to comply with this law." Part of an effort to create a facade of urban order in preparation for two international summits on development and poverty that were soon to be hosted a couple of miles down the avenue, the poster helps to explain the generalized environment of policing that prompted Alfredo to imagine a mother's version of Maranguita, Lima's infamous youth detention center. Furthermore, a widespread rumor had been circulating that this facility was doubling as an emergency containment site for street kids who exceeded the capacity of the already overflowing state orphanages, helping explain the threat of a roundup that prompted the self-imposed evacuation of the street and corner on that particular sunny summer day. So all of this helps to contextualize the inescapable surveillance under which children like Alfredo and mothers like Clelia work day in and day out, resulting in their internalization of the very gaze that marginalizes them. The intersection, I contend, exists as a dense site of articulation for a broad set of historically grounded and institutionalized discourses about childhood, motherhood, family, and national development. Inscribed into the UN Declaration on the Rights of the Child, the Peruvian Code for Children and Adolescents, NGO interventions, media representation, and municipal poster campaigns. The adjacent municipality, in fact, had launched a poster campaign the year before with the slogan, "Behind every child that works is an adult that exploits." But to comprehend the force of this message, containing a caricature of a terrified child running away from a giant disembodied hand, and to comprehend how it is that the agent of exploitation is imagined to be the mother, it's important to understand the way poor children, deviant mothers, and national development emerged as in Peru as a conceptual triad. The role of the child in imagining Peru's social order has, like in many other nations, a long history. According to historian Bianco Premo, the colonial period saw the creation of a legal apparatus through which the ideal patriarchal family, characterized by a hierarchical relationship between father and child, served as a model for a system of governance whereby colonial subjects were to obey the absolute power of the Spanish father king. The patriarchal model has had a lasting legacy in Peru. In fact, the very impossibility of actualizing the model at the level of the individual family led the colonial state to legitimize its role as surrogate patriarch through a host of residential institutions for abandoned, neglected, or delinquent children. Such a regulatory apparatus took on new forms as Peru achieved independence and became a nation. In the early 1900s, less than a century after Peru's independence from Spain, politicians, doctors, and philanthropists became increasingly preoccupied with modernizing Peru. Along with the backward and uncivilized Indian masses and their urban descendants, the child, the inheritors of the nation's destiny and thus the embodiment of both the uncertainty and promise of Peru's future, emerged as a central object of concern. What followed was an explosion of conferences, commissions, and institutions promoting the well-being of the child through scientific studies and direct interventions that targeted indigent mothers, either by separating them from their children or by teaching them to properly mother, depending on the severity of the child's abnormality, which is actually what the institutional language that was used to describe poor children. In the neoliberal moment, old ways of understanding social order and national progress have rearticulated themselves through a discourse of privatized and post-patriarchal developmentalism, which I'll explain in a second. In today's Peru, and in many other countries in the global south, NGOs and transnational development, and the transnational development apparatus to which they are attached, powerfully shape people's everyday understandings of difference and constitute a significant sector of the economy, operating in conjunction with state institutions and increasingly corporations. NGOs emerged in, or non-governmental organizations, NGOs, emerged in Peru in the latter half of the 1990s, largely to address the devastating effects of a two-decade internal war. Regarded with suspicion by the populist, neoliberal, corrupt, human rights abusing, democratically elected dictator, Alberto Fujimori, he really was sort of quite a paradox. NGOs did not truly boom until Fujimori fled the country at the turn of the millennium, opening the path for the return to democracy. Seeking to promote a rhetorical alternative to Fujimori's politics of asistencialismo, handouts, or paternalismo, paternalism, NGOs focused on empowering the poor and marginalizing, and the poor and marginalized, and prioritizing human rights. Middle-class professionals were excited about this new paradigm, but interestingly, the poor, Fujimori's major basis of support, were ambivalent about the change, which I can talk about a little bit later. Well-intentioned for the most part, NGOs reveal practical, conceptual, and ideological flaws. They tend to work on the basis of short-term projects that often inefficient target specific beneficiary populations, as opposed to addressing the need for widespread social services, let alone structural change. And as a result, many people are left out. And again, later I can talk about sort of my research with NGOs that address child labor and attempts to eradicate it. But aside from NGOs' exclusionary power, the development discourse, as anthropologist Arturo Escobar has argued, reproduces difference through understandings of progress that approach marginalized people as subjects in need of development or pathological populations in need of normalization. I suggest that the women's empowerment access of development, again, the well-intentioned, helps to reproduce mothers, if not as the object of blame, then as the agents of responsibility for their children's labor. In a context in which child labor fails to correspond to a sweatshop or sort of a Fagan model, in which the father is assumed to be absent or uninvolved, and in a context in which the father is assumed to be absent or uninvolved, multiple versions of maternal deviance and responsibility emerge. So one common trope that I came upon a lot, the one that Clelia actually throws at Alfredo in their exchange in the intersection, is that the mother is coercive and abusive, that she forces her child to labor on the street and beats him if he doesn't bring home enough money. Another representation is that the mother is lazy, so lazy that instead of going out and finding work, she sends her children out to work instead. And many people who expressed this view to me also argued that it involves a degree of manipulation on the part of the mother. Knowing her child's cuteness is likely to attract a positive response from passersby, the mother is therefore wrongly socializing her child. She's socializing her child to be cunning and deceptive. Of course, one of the failures of this perspective is that it doesn't recognize that often when women do stay at home, it's to perform unremunerated domestic labor. And that in any case, her child labor tends to be part of a whole family division of labor. So finally, the trope of ignorant mother. In many ways, this is the most dangerous form of pathologization. The ignorant mother, so it goes, doesn't realize that the street is a dangerous place for children, or that her children's income isn't actually going to help get the family out of poverty. In any of these versions, it's the mother who, in failing to properly discipline her child, emerges as the agent of her child's exploitation. And insofar as street labor represents social disorder and underdevelopment, the mother also then becomes a primary obstacle to national development. So I was going to read a little bit more, but I'm actually going to stop there, sort of abruptly. And that way we can have some more time for conversation, question, and clarification. So
it's interesting that in both cases, it's the mother who's getting blamed for the child. And what you're saying in at one point about you say it in a couple different ways, but that the child is a person and the child has their own identity and the child can make decisions. That's very important. I mean, back in the 60s, they had a children's liberation movement, and books were written about it and everything, and that's basically the way I try to raise my kids. But if the kids don't turn out, no matter how what you do, the mother is still blamed.
Right.
So it's I wanted to tell you both, do you know, probably do, but in Chicago there's this it's a museum. It's the Hull House Museum. And Hull House was started by this woman named Jane Addams. And she's written, this is like in the early 1900s, late 1800s. And she was like a movement in Chicago, a social movement to, was like before welfare and everything. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of single mothers that stayed at Hull House. Mm-hmm. And anyway, she's written like four or five books. You can get them like probably on the internet. But one of them is about mothers, unmarried mothers, and how until there's a change in societal perception of an unmarried mother, nothing is going to go forward.
Yeah.
Nothing. Yeah. The moral anchor, the moral thing that pulls everybody down. Mm-hmm. And anyway, that's what I was thinking of. She probably will be.
Yeah, that would be really
interesting. And the museum itself, if you ever get to Chicago, the museum is really neat. Yeah. Well, I think you guys are doing a really important job. Your papers will probably be published, I'm assuming, right?
Hopefully. It's part of, we're at that stage where it's hard for us to even write conference papers anymore because we're totally so immersed in our dissertation. Like, I sat down to try and write a conference paper, but I really wound up sort of I was in the middle of redrafting a full chapter from which this work was taken.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of started rewriting the chapter, And so I had a hard time, actually.
Yeah.
Hopefully, the point is, to finish, this bigger project and to have this be, one sort of arm of that. That stuff is important because, the woman Jane Jeffer that I mentioned, her book, called Single Mother, The Emergence of the Domestic Intellectual.
Yes.
that's pretty new, cutting edge stuff in terms of but it's responding directly to what she sees as a major cultural change. Single mothers, so even George W. Bush was getting up there and praising single mothers as sort of the new, single mother, we want social policy that helps single mothers support their families, regardless of what their families may become. But the assumption is always it can't be a state program. It has to be some kind of privatized, helping them actualize the personal responsibility or self-sufficiency that they really want to be. Hopefully, yeah, and that's always the thing though. And she points that out, and I didn't really mention this, is that she mentions shows like Sex and the City, The Gilmore Girls. There's all kinds of Friends, and ultimately the goal is still always to get married. A reward for being a good self-sufficient single mother is marriage to a man at the end.
Yeah. Remember that Murphy Brown?
From the '70s, '80s,
I don't know when that was.
And there was such a backlash from Dan Quayle.
Well, yeah. It was he couldn't see the difference between the fantasy and real life. I mean, he thought
she's self-sufficient.
She was really,
Yeah, but even just why is it so threatening, the idea that single mothers could support themselves or might create an alternative structure of an alternative network of family members, friends, community, and even try to get that more institutionalized so other single moms can take advantage of it, not just in this way like the woman I'm looking at, mother I'm looking at, where it's just sort of she gets lucky that all these working class people come along to help her out.
A true story.
Yeah, it's like her autobiography.
And she was lucky enough to be able to be an artist. Basically, how many other single moms are going through this but not being able to document it or take pictures of their kids, for heaven's sake.
I know.
Kind of mothers I am working with, where
it's really poverty.
Yeah, I mean, she was able to. This is after her education, and after she's achieved some of that capital from having been socially mobile in this way.
Sure.
She's able to do this kind of thing. Yeah.
What was her family background? I mean, was her mom was a single mom?
Yeah, her mom was a single mom, and she grew up poor in Camden, Ohio, I think it was called, and. She was, and the part that I didn't really get around to writing about was she was pretty much abandoned by her family and made to go live with her sister, and she was molested by her brother-in-law. She got pregnant in this kind of under sort of sketchy circumstances that she narrates, where she was maybe raped by somebody that she got in a car with, gave her a ride, and she was on the streets kind of wandering around after her family had kicked her out. And so that was how she originally got pregnant. But her background is pretty much a poverty background. But she was and that's always the thing. How is it that she's able to then, you know, like that desire to go to college and like that sense of herself as like someone who could do that or could find, you know, find a way to make that happen. You know, that comes from somewhere. That comes from some kind
of. Yeah. And it's interesting that her in particular, mm-hmm. I mean, didn't think of any other, she finished high school, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But there wasn't any outlet, you know, besides low-paying jobs, supposedly,
mm-hmm.
or college, mm-hmm. which supposedly is at the end of that rainbow that you're going to get a good
job.
Yeah,
you're going to get a good paying. But that never happened to her either. It's part of it. Like.
Yeah. And I think that if, and like factory work and stuff like that, that people don't really look on with whatever.
Yeah.
If it would be a construction work or, you know, mm-hmm. skilled trades taught more in high schools, some of these young women would realize that they don't have to necessarily go to college.
Right.
That they could make $60,000 to $100,000 a year working a construction job.
Yeah, I know.
That's what we make. I mean, I'm not in construction now,
yeah.
But let me give you what I've got.
Yeah, I mean, but exactly, and like if more emphasis, for instance, was put on like providing high-paying unionized labor, as opposed to like all of this emphasis on like but the education system itself is geared such that it's educate yourself for a trade,
right.
And yet like
especially now when you take it away so many.
But I think that like kind of what I'm trying to say is that like liberal art, like what she wants to do is transform like what a liberal arts education can be, and you know, sort of more from the inside, from the perspective of like being this working class single mother who, you know, in a lot of respects like is extremely underrepresented in like a liberal arts educational context. I mean, there's policies in place to keep single mothers from being able to actually go to 4-year college and graduate with like any kind of liberal arts degree.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's sort of like the other side of like of also like you're saying needing to make, you know, needing to strengthen like the work, you know, the image of and also like the reality in terms of the capital available and the work, you know, those kinds of working class jobs that are already there, and that like why is it that those jobs are, and maybe it's because like the system of like all of these like low paying service sector jobs, that's what a single mother, for instance, might feel they will wind up with, you know, is like that kind of structure that really goes nowhere,
right.
As opposed to like a unionized working class job. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still so much sexism.
Yeah, sexism.
In the trades, that, I mean, some young woman might think that she wants to do it, but then is mm-hmm. afraid to go in because she doesn't want to be sexually harassed. And it's like,
yeah.
Those aren't the jobs for every woman.
Right, it's not really sustainable, and it's, I think that the dream of an education, it almost seems like a way to have an environment that will be more amenable to, like, women, for instance. But at the same time, there's so many sort of bureaucratic limitations put on how far single mothers can go based on like the kind of aid and the kind of support they need to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So
this is these two are little chapbooks from a workshop that I do in California for at a trade union conference.
Yeah.
And these are poems that they have written, and there was quite a few single moms in this workshop, and this is a book I put. These are newsletters that I edit. And
wonderful. Yeah, I think I read something by you. It was published in a volume.
I read a whole bunch of things.
I mean,
that's the part that I didn't pick mm-hmm. out of, because even though I was in the college, I didn't.
It was Jan Vandy.
Rutgers and.
Was either Liberty, was it Liberty Memory?
Yeah,
Liberty
Memory.
That's where I read
it. Yeah,
that you've read. But anyway, do you have any more questions? Or?
I don't understand cultural anthropology that much, and you've helped me understand it. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well,